Good evening and welcome to the local news. Today is Tuesday, April 16th. I'm Lisa Music, reporting for KMUD. In tonight's news, Humboldt Soups briefed on ways to deal with power bills. HCSO seeks assistance finding 37-year-old woman missing since February. And Amy Goodman addresses Packed House in Ukiah. Stay tuned. News on those stories and more coming right up. Power is more expensive, and Humboldt County supervisors convened a presentation on how residents can cope. Daniel Mentz reports.
2024 is the year that power bills jumped by 13%, and with the increase leaning heavily on Humboldt County families, the Board of Supervisors hosted a ratepayers assistance presentation. The Pacific Gas and Electric Company, or PG&E, says wildfire risk reduction and transmission line undergrounding are primary reasons for raising its rates. Other reasons include covering the cost of system upgrades to enhance energy efficiency and reduce carbon emissions. The upshot for ratepayers is higher bills, and Supervisor Steve Madrone, who sponsored the presentation at the April 9th board meeting, said the financial impact is especially hard in rural areas like Humboldt.
I mean, almost everybody I hear is talking about, you know, a doubling of their rates and things like that. And it creates a lot of hardship. So I'm glad there are these programs to try and help people with these rate increases. Starting January 1st, we had a 13% increase. But over the last 3-4 years, there's been a 38% increase in rates over that period of time, which is really putting a lot of hardship on families all over the place. Also, it was reported that there's a statewide 500% increase in back-owed utility bills. In other words, more and more people are falling in arrears, you know, with their bills and having a hard time catching up. That's a really significant hurdle for a lot of people to overcome. And it's not just electricity, it's also gas rates going up as well.
Allison Talbot of PG&E outlined various programs that income-eligible bill payers can sign up for. They include the REACH program, which helps those facing disconnection, the CARE program for 20% monthly discounts, and the Family Electric Rate Assistance program for a similar discount on electricity charges. Other programs help with power costs related to medical devices, federal payments to help with heating expenses, and energy-related home improvements. Talbot said PG&E is also cost-cutting on over 150 of its projects, including vegetation management and undergrounding, and expenses like insurance. But Supervisor Mike Wilson said PG&E's profit-oriented service model limits rate moderation.
And I do appreciate Allison, you know, talking about all of the expenditures and expenses, and then also the cost reductions that PG&E is going through in order to, I assume, help us with rates. Again, it doesn't speak to the loss from profit, frankly, which is what we pay. If you're paying into PG&E, you don't get any service for that. Doesn't get reinvested back into the community. It's purely a cut off of that, which is why people talk about community owned utility investments. And it's essentially an inefficiency in the system. And it is interesting that you have now this organization, a private entity that is taking profits and then also asking for public monies for these various enterprises.
Also in the presentation was Sally Regley of the Redwood Coast Energy Authority, or RCEA, a local joint powers agency that buys and then sells power to residents using PG&E's infrastructure and having the company administrate billing. Regley said opting for RCEA power instead of PG&E's gives ratepayers a slight savings that in total amounts to about $6 million a year. regularly advised power customers to pay attention to higher rates during the peak time of 4 p.m. to 9 p.m., and power use that goes above what's considered the baseline for a customer's location. Talbot answered a question about the next cost-related change, implementation of the state's income-graduated fixed charge.
Most recently, and by recently, I think it's last week, the CPUC, the California Public Utilities Commission came out with their proposal, which looks to be what's moving forward, and they have proposed a $24 and change monthly flat fee for customers for the maintenance and repair and investment in the actual infrastructure of the system. So that is separate from energy use. The fixed charge seeks to make electrifying homes and transportation more affordable. And the commissioners could vote on this new billing structure at the CPUC's May 9th open meeting. And if approved, the charges would go into effect no sooner than 2025. So it would be next summer. And I genuinely believe, Supervisor, that's the earliest date.
Supporters of the fixed charge say it will help lower income residents, but there's disagreement about that and other aspects. Ratepayer assistance has a lot of moving parts, and more specific information can be had by calling the RCEA at 707-269-1700 or going to its website at redwoodenergy.org. In Eureka for KMUD News, this is Daniel Mintz.
The Humboldt County Sheriff's Office is seeking the public's assistance in locating 37-year-old Jennifer Johnson, who has not been seen since February 2024. According to family members, Johnson struggles with drug addiction and has been staying with friends. She is described as a white female, approximately 5'4" tall, weighing about 135 pounds, with blue eyes and brown-red hair, featuring shaved sides. Johnson typically wears dark clothing and has a cross tattoo on one of her thumbs. Known to frequent Eureka, Fortuna, and Carlotta, she may also have traveled to the Hoopa area. Anyone with information on Jennifer Johnson's whereabouts is urged to contact the Humboldt County Sheriff's Office at 707-445-7251 or Investigator Mike Fridley at 707-441-3024. You can see a photo of Johnson on the KMUD News social media pages. The first set of bills based on recommendations from the California Reparations Task Force is winding its way through the legislature, and a key bill on eminent domain has a hearing on Tuesday. Suzanne Potter reports.
A hearing is set for tomorrow in Sacramento on a key bill recommended by the California Reparations Task Force. The State Senate Judiciary Committee will consider SB 1050, which would reimburse people or their descendants who lost property to racially motivated eminent domain without fair compensation. Bill co-author State Senator Stephen Bradford says this is a first step toward redressing historical injustices that disproportionately impacted Black people.
This is a real stain on America, the sin of slavery. Most people don't even understand that most of the wealth in this country is dependent on 400 years of free labor. We still have a racist core in America.
The bill is part of a package of 14 bills supported by the California Legislative Black Caucus to address many issues, including homeownership, property tax relief in redlined communities, and a formal apology from Governor Gavin Newsom for California's history of anti-Black racism. Mandela Kaisi is an educational and community planning consultant and a member of the City of Los Angeles Reparations Advisory Commission.
There's a large majority of Black folks who favor reparations. The skepticism is whether or not any government body will actually deliver. You know, we've never had a moment in our history where reparations was taken up as seriously as it has been in the current era.
The LA Commission is still in its information gathering process and expects to release its recommendations by December. None of the bills currently proposed calls for direct cash payments to descendants of slaves. Advocates note, however, that the U.S. has paid reparations before to Japanese Americans imprisoned in internment camps during World War II. This story was produced with original reporting from Aaron Aubrey Kaplan for Yes Magazine. For California News Service, I'm Suzanne Potter. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
The Redway Community Water District will be holding their monthly meeting tomorrow, April 17th.
Hi, this is Glenn. I'm the office manager here at the Redway Community Services District for the water and sewer provider here in Redway. Hey, just giving you guys a reminder that tomorrow, Wednesday, April 17th at 5:30 p.m., we're having our monthly board meeting. This is a live meeting. The public is welcome to attend. We go over all types of things about what's going on in the district, about place of use, and then whether or not, you know, about additional wells and about the security and the future of the district.
The board will be discussing district boundary upgrades, commercial cannabis zoning of the business park, landlord responsibility for unpaid water bills, and much more. Graydon encourages RCSD customers to join the conversation.
The public is always welcome and invited. If you can't join us live, you can always send us a letter or a text or an email a couple days in advance, a week in advance, and we can help address it during the next board meeting. Thank you very much. Hope to see you there.
The meeting will be held in person at the RCSD Business Office, located at 1150 Evergreen Road, space number 2, in the Meadows Business Park, tomorrow, April 17th at 5:30 p.m. Turning to Mendocino, Amy Goodman, the host of Democracy Now!, was in Northern California over the weekend to speak about the bombing of Gaza and the role of the media in times of conflict. KZYX's Sarah Reith reports.
Amy Goodman, the host of Democracy Now!, was in Northern California over the weekend to speak about the bombing of Gaza and the role of the media in times of conflict. On Friday, she addressed a packed crowd at the Space Theater in Ukiah, and the next day she was in Berkeley to celebrate the 75th birthday of KPFA. Though she was a little late due to the earthquake in New York, she received a standing ovation at Space before she even began to speak. She told the crowd that organizations like the Ku Klux Klan, which bombed Pacifica Radio twice at its inception, find public media dangerous for a reason.
Because it allows people to speak for themselves. And when you hear someone speaking from their own experience, whether it is a Palestinian child or the granddaughter of a Holocaust survivor, whether it's an aunt from Iraq or an uncle from Afghanistan, when you hear them describing their own experience, you identify, even if you don't agree. I mean, even if you say, he reminds me of my uncle who I hate, but it makes you much less likely to want to destroy the person. That understanding is the beginning of peace. I think the media can be the greatest force for peace on earth. Instead, all too often, it is wielded as a weapon of war, which is why we have to take the media back. How do we understand the rest of the world outside of knowing people from different places? And how does the rest of the world understand us? It has to be through something other than a corporate lens.
She said Western reporters are facing difficulties reporting from Gaza.
Israel doesn't allow Western journalists in Gaza because they know, Netanyahu knows the power of these images. He says the images of the dead will be used for propaganda purposes. And now the Knesset has just passed a law that Netanyahu says he will use to ban Al Jazeera. This global network that is one of the only global networks that not only bring you the voices of the Palestinians, but of Israeli officials every single day. The U.S. networks have something to learn from them. But when the networks like CNN bring you reporters from Tel Aviv and Jerusalem, they should have to say to you every time they bring you one of those reporters, remember, we are not allowed in Gaza unless we are embedded with the Israeli Defense Forces who are there to show you a tunnel, for example. On Democracy Now!, We brought you the report of the tunnels under Al-Shifa that Israel knows well because they built them. Israel, with Israeli architects, Israeli blueprints, when they were in Gaza, because the real estate, to say the least, was very tight, they started building down. And so they will bring sometimes, occasionally, a reporter embedded in the forces. But to allow reporters to be there to speak to people, that's left to Palestinian journalists, and more than 100 of them have been killed.
On Friday morning, President Joe Biden called Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu to press for an immediate ceasefire. Though the U.S. has vetoed ceasefire resolutions in the past, on Friday, Biden also asked Netanyahu to allow more humanitarian aid to Palestinians who've been displaced and are facing starvation, and to ask for more measures to protect civilians. Goodman shared a lengthy clip from a Palestinian doctor living in America who refused to attend a Ramadan dinner at the White House because of U.S. support for Israel's bombing of Gaza. The doctor said that at least 100 members of his family, including many children and young adults, had been killed. Goodman believes that the U.S. support for Israel is becoming a political liability for Biden.
Biden is running scared right now because he is running for president. And those who would support him, who probably would not vote for Donald Trump, are leading campaigns around the country simply not to vote, or to vote, but to vote in Michigan, it was uncommitted. Same in Hawaii, something like 29% of the Democrats is, I think in New York, it was called this past Tuesday, leave the box blank. The way President Biden won last time was with the incredible passion and energy and a base that was galvanized to get out many people to vote. And that's what it is sinking in for him and his staff, a number of whom have been trying to tell him, is that if they don't have that, they don't have a victory in November. And it doesn't mean that people are supporting Donald Trump.
Goodman closed with the story of Hans and Sophie Scholl, who were executed by the Nazis during World War II for distributing anti-war pamphlets.
That philosophy, that motto, should be the Hippocratic Oath of all journalists today, should be the Hippocratic Oath of us all today. We will not be silent.
Democracy Now! Airs on KZYX from 4 to 5 p.m. Monday through Friday. For KZYX News, I'm Sarah Wright.
In state news, anti-Gaza war protesters shut down traffic on Bay Area freeways and around the nation. Ben Klein from KPFA reports.
The protest began early this morning at the West Oakland BART station, where hundreds gathered to march onto the southbound I-880 freeway. The approximately 300 protesters blocked traffic on the freeway for close to 5 hours before the California Highway Patrol dispersed them. Protesters said the 880, Oakland, and Golden Gate Bridge actions were part of a global economic blockade against the ongoing Middle East war. Similar protests took place in 54 other cities worldwide. Protesters said they hope the protests will disrupt the global economy and pressure lawmakers to end their support for Israel until it ends its war in Gaza and its occupation of Palestine. Lakota activist Hey Shawia summed up the protests' aims.
If you look at, you know, who's funding our representatives, money is what talks to them. And I think, like, to have this worldwide economic blockade, which has spread to over 55 cities and 6 continents, the world is speaking very loudly about what we want to see, and that's a liberated Palestine.
Protesters took over southbound I-880 and also blocked traffic on the northbound direction of the freeway for several hours. That's where protesters chained themselves to 55-gallon drums filled with cement. Protesters also blocked traffic for over 4 hours on the Golden Gate Bridge. CHP said 20 arrests were made there. Meanwhile, the Oakland Marine terminals were shut down today in anticipation of protests there. A line of bicyclists blocked oncoming traffic on the freeway at around 8 a.m. A pickup truck carrying a generator and speakers led the crowd onto the freeway, where protesters chanted, danced, and ate bagels and grapefruit. CHP officers first arrived on the scene around 9:30, when they arrested one protester. Police waited until around 12:30 to push the crowd back down the on-ramp. Despite the arrests, protesters said they were optimistic that the economic disruption of today's protest would bring attention to the issue. Protester Hank McClellan said the disruption was essential to the protest.
Public attention is really important, and to get the attention of the power brokers in the U.S., you need to disrupt the economy. So we want to make those guys anxious, you know, and we want to hit them in the pockets, hit them where it hurts.
Police arrested five people at the southbound 880 protest. 38 protesters were arrested in total, the CHP said. For KPFA News, I'm Ben Klein.
UN debates Iran-Israel tensions following Iranian strike aimed at Israel. Christina Alfandari from KPFA brings you this report.
United Nations Secretary General Antonio Guterres condemned Iran's attack on Israel. He also urged all parties to prevent further escalation.
The people of the region are confronting a real danger of a devastating full-scale conflict. Now is the time to defuse and de-escalate. Now is the time for maximum restraint.
Israeli Ambassador Gilad Erdan, though, made it clear his country will retaliate for the unprecedented Iranian attack on Israeli soil, despite the minimal damage which it inflicted.
While the Ayatollah regime thinks, they only think, that Israel is a frog in a boiling water, that we are becoming accustomed to the threats on our survival and won't notice until it's too late, they are wrong. You are wrong. This attack crossed every red line, and Israel reserves the legal right to retaliate.
The Israeli ambassador repeatedly referred to Iran's leaders as Nazis.
The Islamic regime of today is no different than the Third Reich, and Ayatollah Khamenei is no different than Adolf Hitler.
Erdogan urged the Security Council to reimpose crippling sanctions on Iran and to designate its powerful paramilitary guard corps a terrorist organization. For his part, Iran's ambassador, Amir Saeed Iravani, said Iran retaliated only after the UN Security Council failed to denounce Israel's deadly attack on an Iranian consular building in Syria on April 1st. Iravani criticized the U.S., Britain, and France for opposing a Russian-drafted statement that would have condemned that Israeli attack.
Faced with such circumstances, the Islamic Republic of Iran had no choice but to exercise its inherent right to self-defense under international law.
The Iranian ambassador also said his nation does not seek escalation or war in the region. He directed his statement directly to the U.S., which helped shoot down Iranian drones and missiles targeting Israel this weekend.
Iran has no intention of engaging in conflict with the U.S. in the region. However, if the U.S. initiate military operation against Iran, its citizen, or its security and interest, Iran will use its inherent right to respond proportionately.
While Israel's war cabinet debates how to respond to Iran's attack, the Biden administration has made it clear it does not want the U.S. drawn into direct conflict with Iran. U.S. Deputy Ambassador Robert Wood condemned Iran and said the Security Council had an obligation not to let its attack go unanswered, but he said the U.S. does not seek escalation.
Our goal is to de-escalate and then get back to the issue at hand, securing an end to the conflict in Gaza by getting a ceasefire in Gaza through a hostage deal, as well as surging humanitarian assistance to Palestinians in need.
Russian Ambassador Vasily Nebenzia accused the U.S. and its allies of hypocrisy and said if any of their diplomatic missions had been attacked, as was Iran's, they would have rained down reprisals on the perpetrators. He spoke through an interpreter who made an apparent error in naming Iraq instead of Iran.
What happened in the night of the 14th of April did not happen in a vacuum. The steps undertaken by Iraq became a reaction to a disgraceful inaction by the Security Council.
Nebenzia also urged all parties to exercise restraint and the international community to take action.
The spiral of confrontation and bloodshed must be stopped. We think it's urgent for the entire international community to undertake all efforts necessary to de-escalate the situation.
After the meeting, this month's president of the UN Security Council, Malta's Vanessa Fraser, told reporters she believed that all the council members shared her view that there should be no further escalation in the conflict between Israel and Iran. Fraser said it's important to get back to the priority issue, which is the war in Gaza.
First of all, the ceasefire. Secondly, not in order of importance, of course, but the release, the unconditional release of hostages and the delivery of humanitarian aid. Those have to remain the priorities. There should be no further escalations. We should not lose our focus from what the priorities are.
For KPFA News, I'm Eileen Alfandari.
That's all for tonight's broadcast. Thank you for listening. Thanks to our engineer, Jumpshot Jordan, and thanks to our reporters, Daniel Mentz, Suzanne Potter, Sarah Wright, Ben Klein, and Eileen Alfandari. KMUD News is online. You can find us on kmud.org, SoundCloud, Instagram, and Facebook. That's where you can see related stories, links, and videos. If you have questions or suggestions, you can give us a call at 707-923-2605 or send an email to news@kmud.org. Reporting from the KMUD studio in Redway, I'm Lisa Music.